I love the smell of napalm in the morning. You know, one time we had a hail bomb for 12 hours when it was all over. I walked up. We didn't find one of them, not one stinking body. Smell, you know, that gasoline smell. A whole hill. Smelled like victory.
Hello and welcome to Book Versus Movie. This is a podcast where we read books that have been adapted into movies, and then we try to decide which we like better, the book or the movie. I am Margot P. of ColoniaBook.com, and this is my good friend and co-host, Margot D. of Brooklyn Fit Chick.
Hi, everyone.
Happy New Year.
Yes.
We were just catching up our New Year's non-news, which, you know what, in light of last year, I'll take a non-eventful January. Thank you very much. Yes, please. Welcome. We've picked up a lot of new listeners lately. So if you are new, here's the deal. We're not film majors. We're going to talk about a very film majory film. We're not experts, and I'm sure we're going to just scratch the surface, and I'm sure we're going to make a lot of errors. And that's what you're in for if you're a big film buff and you love this movie. We dabble every year, every week. It's a new book, it's a new movie, and we learn about something new. And it's just our little book club of the air. And we really thank you for coming along for the ride. If you have suggestions for books and movies, it is a brand new year. We are continuing to do a brand new episode every single week. You can make those suggestions in a couple of places online. You can also interact with both of us, Margot's, and other listeners of this podcast.
Yes, we do have a basic Facebook page. I'll be honest, I don't always check it. But all the episodes are definitely posted there first. But we have a private Facebook group, and it's the best place to kind of interact with us. And we've created a space where it's a private group on Facebook, and we really just talk about books and movies. It's pretty cool. So just type in Book vs Movie Podcast Group in Facebook and ask to join, and we would love to get your suggestions. You can also do so via Twitter or Instagram. Our handles there are Book versus a Movie. Just spell that out. You can also just be old-fashioned and send us an email. It's Book versus Movie Podcast, spelled it all out, at gmail.com. We also have stickers and magnets. If you would like some merch, that's what you do. Just send us an email, give us your address, and we will drop them in the mail for you.
That's right. And if you really, really enjoy the show and you want to help us keep things going around here, you can also join us on Patreon. Just saying.
Yeah. My friend Jackie is a Patreon member, and she sent me a Christmas card and wrote on her Christmas card to me, "Hey, can you redo the Joseph Conrad book, Heart of Darkness / Apocalypse Now? I think you need to do a redo of it." And so Margot and I have said, of course. And just go to patreon.com, P-A-T-R-E-O-N. All of the episodes that we have done, we've been doing the show 7 to 8 years for now. So from 2019 and then previous that, they're all on the Patreon wall. There's also a bunch of things there that are free. So just go to there to check out some of the free stuff that we've got. And thank you, Jackie, so much for doing that. We really appreciate it.
It's true. We did this a long time ago. It was many years ago now. It does warrant a redo. I just feel like I have to put it out there, you guys, that, and it's not the movie. I mean, it's on all the lists. This movie is on all of the lists. It won all of the awards. Just me personally, Margot P., I have a bad attitude about this movie.
Okay.
just because I've seen it so many times. I don't even want to think about how many times I've seen this movie. I almost know it by heart. I have a little bit of an eye roll attitude about it. And I'm sorry, I'm going to apologize in advance if that leaks through. We have talked about Francis Ford Coppola a great deal. He is one of these directors that his kind of MO is doing adaptations from literary sources, you know, similar to a Steven Spielberg. Thank you. There's several that are, that's kind of what they do, and they do it super, super well. So we've done a lot of Francis Ford Coppola. We've done The Godfather. I think we did Dracula. Didn't we do his Dracula?
No,
am I remembering that?
No. It was Frankenstein.
Oh, yes. That's right.
With Kenneth Branagh.
Woof.
We love The Godfather. I think that's on our Patreon wall. Yes.
That we do. That we do. That's a great one. Anyway, so I just want to, he's a great one. I mean, we're not even, nobody's questioning that. But let's get into it. Let's talk first about Joseph Conrad and the Heart of Darkness.
What's interesting to me is someone who is considered one of the great writers, stars of English literature. He was Polish and he didn't even learn to speak English until his 20s or write English until he was 30. He was born in a part of, it was actually the Russian Empire, and his parents had Polish origins, and they were both very political people and were fighting for freedom. But he lost both of his parents before he was even 13. They were very young when they died, and then he went to live with an uncle, took him in and educated him. He could speak, I believe it was French and Greek and German and Polish. I mean, he was intelligent.
Interesting character. Yeah. Yes, indeed.
He was a very smart man. He had spent some time in the French Navy and then the British Navy. He had spent some time in the Congo. And so this is why he has all of this information for us. His first work was called Almayer's Folly, and that was in 1895. There's a book called Narcissus. I mean, there's a word before that, which we won't say on the show. He died in 1924 at the age of 66. He had had a lot. He was a very sickly person, had a lot of issues. You know, there's different ways to read Heart of Darkness, and some of the, it's funny to like go through YouTube and go through these. I like to look up, I'm kind of nerdy. I look up people who analyze books and stuff like
all the analyses. Yes.
Analysis. Yeah. And some people are like, is it racist? Or some people are like, of course it's racist. Or some people say,
yeah.
But if you think about it, he wrote this in 1899, and who else was talking about being anti-colonialism in 1899? That's a
right.
That's a decent point. But then he writes characters that have his African characters, have no personality of their own. They have no voice.
It's just the literally color of their voice. Skin, basically. Yeah, literally no voice.
Right.
I mean, it's complicated. It's sort of, it reminded me very much of when we talk about The Wizard of Oz and you talk about Frank L. Baum. And if you don't know, you haven't heard that episode, Frank L. Baum, in addition to writing these incredible books, also wrote some extremely disturbing stuff about, you know, indigenous Americans. And some scholars go, oh, well, he, you know, it was a satire. Oh, you know, he didn't really feel this way. And the truth is, like, we don't know. We don't have the context to make that call. We just don't. And I think this is a similar thing that, you know, I don't think that anybody reading this book is going to come away thinking that colonialism is awesome, right? So,
no, they won't.
So it's definitely not a defense of colonialism and imperialism and racism even, but you know, it's a racist, it's an overtly racist, systemically racist culture that he's living in and writing about. It's unavoidable, really.
Right. It didn't even start with, but let's just say, I mean, part of it is the King of Belgium, King Leopold, came to Africa because they had all this ivory, decided this is a cool thing to have, and so they just take over all these nations. And they have this ivory trading business. And they tell people, either you work for us or we'll kill you. And you either deliver this amount of ivory to us or we'll cut your hands off. And if you really misbehave and talk back, because we can't understand you, we'll put chains around your neck and we'll chain you all together in a chain gang. There's all kinds of things that happen like that. And at the time, and I'm doing actually a story for What a Creep about Canadian Indigenous schools that happened, that started in the 1800s. And this is this idea that European culture was the highest culture possible. And that wherever Europeans went to colonize, they need to change things. It would make people's lives better.
Right. Like their souls will go to heaven.
Right.
And so we're going to drag you kicking and screaming into our culture, you know, whether it's turns out to be the right thing or not. Yeah, it's very that, definitely. Mm-hmm.
Right. And that's the thing that he's talking about. And then at the time, it was considered very adventurous to talk about this because he's speaking against doing that. I would also argue he doesn't give any of the African characters any personality. They're just treated, you know, as enslaved people.
Yeah, it's really icky.
Yeah. It's a sausage fest.
And this is a book we should, oh boy. So that's the other thing. So this book, I don't know. I forget what the original reception of it. I think it was received awfully well. It was originally published as a magazine serial, mm-hmm. as many of our stories have been that we've talked about, these classic books. Yeah, it's very like one woman character. Is there one on the boat with him? And it's a book that, before we get into talking about the plot and all of that, bearing in mind, this is a book that was really like a integral part of, especially in the Americas, the American curriculum, mm-hmm. Kind of high school literature curriculum, you know, from the early 20th century until like the 60s. So we'll talk, I'm sure, about Orson Welles' adaptation of this book. I'm sure he read it in high school. Certainly all of these directors, your Lucas, your Coppola, Spielberg, all of these men as boys had to read this book. And I'm sure it was a book that, being the daughter of an English teacher, I'm sure it was a book that was on the curriculum to encourage boys to read. Because it's a big sausage fest, macho adventure story. And so it's a book that kind of, I don't know, I don't know if it's because as a woman or just as a person, I'm like, really, this book again?
Yeah.
We're going to tell this story? We got to adapt this again? Oh, there's so many adaptations of this freaking story. And it's not a long book. It's just... It's not my favorite.
Yeah. Well, let's just kind of go into it. So it's published in 1899. Like as Margot said, it was serialized in magazines. And back then, magazines were very thick. They were full of stories and short stories. And people bought magazines all the time. It was a very popular way to get a book deal. You know, you sold a few stories and then...
Yeah, like Sherlock Holmes or a lot of things that we've covered. Dickens, yeah.
Right. The story is about Charles Marlowe. He's the narrator that tells this story. And he's on the River Thames with a few other blokes. They're on a boat and they're waiting for the tide to come in. They just start shooting the shit, basically. He brings up he brings up the idea of mentioning a man named Kurtz. And Mr. Kurtz was a gentleman sent to the Congo to run an ivory operation. And he was so good and made so much money that everybody was talking about him and that other countries were coming in trying to glom onto what he was doing. That Kurtz was the greatest.
Or get his trade secrets. Yeah, right. Yeah. And the book opens up. And it's okay. Again, I warned you, I have a bad attitude about the book and the movie. Again, it's a classic of literature that generations of kids were made to read this book. So it opens with they're on this. The narrator, Marlowe, he's older. He's on this boat on the Thames in England. And it's kind of like a lazy day on the boat. I forget why they're on the boat in the first place. There's a reason. Doesn't really matter. And he says, he's describing the boat and he's describing what he's seeing on the river. And he's like, and you know what, how it happens sometimes you're sitting on a boat like this and people start telling stories. And he's like, yeah, I remember. This reminds me of when I was a young man and I was in the Congo. I was taking a boat up a river in the Congo and I was on this mission. And then he proceeds to gab his freaking head off for the rest. Apparently nobody else on the boat has anything to say because this guy is not shutting up about the Congo. And the whole time I'm like, what about these poor people on the boat in London? What are they making of all this? Maybe they don't want to hear about your bizarre story of colonialism and murder, Mr. Marlowe. But anyway, he's talking about in his youth. Yeah, he's as Conrad did. He's running a riverboat, working for this company. You know, it's sort of like an East India Company sort of a situation where these corporate interests I mean, try to wrap your head around this. Corporate interests mm-hmm. were controlling all of the natural resources and the lives of the people who lived on the land. For Ivory, in this case, this Marlowe, who was like their best guy, he was like their ace number one guy. How does Marlowe do it? Make us so much money. Marlowe has gone rogue and seems to have really lost his mind. He's living among the people he's supposed to be exploiting, like a good colonialist, you know, merchant. He's living among them and they are worshiping him like a god. We don't know what's going on, but you know, maybe you need to go in there and take him out. Then it's a story of like all the things that he encounters, Marlowe encounters on the river on the way to Kurtz. And there's a lot of, it's a whole like meandering, you know, this happens and then that happens. And it's all happening on the river as we're going down the river to go kill this guy. And that's where some of the problematic things is, you know, there's a lot of talk of people as savages. That's yes. a word that comes up quite a bit. Again, like I would be so infuriated if I were stuck on a boat in the Thames in London with this guy.
Well, he's talking about this story and Kurtz once again. Everyone loves Kurtz. Everyone's talking about Kurtz. Everyone thinks he's the greatest thing since sliced bread. He was tough. He was smart. He figured out the best way to do everything. He was also a tyrant. He, you know, exploited people. He killed people who got in his way, much as like it did in real life. I mean, they lost half their population there due to this crap.
I mean, that was a thing that happened. That's how it went down. And again, so we've been talking about this book, like it's describing that. I appreciate that too, that he's not
sugarcoating it.
He's not glorifying it or sugarcoating it. Mm-hmm. And I think that's to be commended. There is a lot of racism there.
It's disturbing.
You just can't get away. It is. It's hard. It's hard to get through sometimes.
Yeah. And he meets somebody that a Russian that says, oh, I met Kurtz once and boy, is he gone nutty. And I don't know if you're going to take him out alive. Kurtz is pretty scary. You know, everyone worships him. They think he's a god because he's a white man in charge. Part of that. But he's taking over their community. And Marlowe's like, well, you know, got a job to do. And he meets up with Kurtz and it's pretty gruesome. He shows up at the house and there's a sign for him. And then there's these heads on spikes all around the property.
It's grisly. And I appreciate that it's the impression is not that it's, although he's, again, the word savage is used a lot. But it's in this case, it's that this Kurtz, whom they worship, is kind of commanding that they do this. He's the driving force of this butchery and violence.
Right. And then he becomes less of a person doing it on behalf of a company and more on doing it behalf of the people. He's taking over them. And so he's, yeah. I'm one of you now, but I'm also the boss. He and Marlowe, they meet up and he meets Kurtz and he's like, what? You're the guy that everyone's talking about? Because he's so thin and worn out.
Yeah. So let's talk about that, because yes. a great deal of the book is devoted to the description of, so there's the book is the whole time he's going down the river and this myth of this man is building and building and how smart he is and how capable he is and how powerful he is. Da, 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 da. And when he finally arrives and meets Kurtz and walks into the place, he's this frail little matchstick man. He's like this, just... He's just this tight, like you could snap him in half and, you know, emaciated and raving. And, you know, oh, this is the guy that's causing all this death out there. This is the guy that, you know, swooped in and took the whole place over for the Ivory Company. Are you kidding me? This guy? But a great deal is made of how frail and emaciated, how wasted away he has become in the jungle. Skin and bones is he.
Exactly. And so Marlowe is taking him back. As he's taking him back, there's some back and forth, you know, with the people that live there, the indigenous people. He gets on the boat and he's getting sicker and sicker and sicker. And so Marlowe's trying to talk to him about, well, what happened and what was going on. And, you know, in a very quick, you know, just to say, we spoil the details, by the way. Anyway, Kurtz is very much at near death. He has a fiance, by the way, that's worried about him, that he's, you know, engaged, you know, some, a woman out there.
Yeah, I wasn't very clear about how long Kurtz has been away from this fiance.
Yeah, they don't really say.
Because it seems like it's a super long time for this woman to be waiting for him back in England. But maybe
everyone loved Kurtz.
I couldn't tell.
Kurtz was the guy. Boy, Kurtz was the richest, the smartest, the whatever. And Kurtz, at the end of his life, he's laying in this boat. He's dying of all kinds of illnesses. And then he just says, the horror, the horror. And that's his last words. Marlo comes back to Europe. Yep.
Yeah, you'd think that would be the end of the book. Oh, but no, it's not.
No.
No. No, we've got lots more to go in this short little book.
Yeah, yeah, he comes back to... you know, he comes back to Europe and he's so angry at this civilized world and these people don't know things and they're.
Yes. He has a packet of papers that Kurtz has given him. Right.
Right.
And it's his. He has all these Marlowe, who's Kurtz is dead. Marlowe's back in England with the papers. And all these people are coming out of the workbook like, oh, those are his big trade secrets. Like how to get all the ivory and make all the money. I'll pay you X amount for the trade secrets. And he's like, no. And this happens several times over and over again. What it is actually is some kind of an account of how he slowly lost his grip on reality, I think is what it ends up being. So he has a mission to deliver it. He's promised Kurtz he's going to deliver it to his ex-partner or somebody to publish it, right?
Yeah, it's for a journalist. It's for somebody to expose what's going on here, what the price really is of what's going on.
Yeah,
here.
Again, not in favor of this, what's going on over there.
Right.
But then he also decides to go and see the fiance and spend a great deal of time with her.
They talk a while. She must be really pretty.
It's a long combo.
It's a long convo. And she basically says, what were his last words? And he just sits and then he says, he said your name. He was calling out for you. And, you know, why does he do that? Because he's somebody that's talking about the truth, you know, the truth, the truth, the truth, everything. You know, people lie all over the place. And then he's given the chance to tell her the truth and he lies to her.
But we've at this point, we've seen Marlo. Yeah, Marlo has been throughout the whole story that he's telling himself on this very long boat ride in the Thames. But he is, yeah, he's like, no, I've got this mission. I'm sticking to the mission. He is a truthful person. You know, he could easily have been like, you know what? Kurtz is dead. You want to buy these papers? How much? But he doesn't do that. You know, he's a person of integrity. And I guess it comes down to is integrity, having integrity more important than being honest.
Right.
And in that moment, he decides that it's more important to preserve the lady's integrity and not shatter her very solidified and thorough and detailed vision of her fiance.
Right.
By saying like, you know, he kind of went cuckoo and was lopping people's heads off at the end.
He murdered a lot
of people.
He didn't
really mention you. Yeah.
He was a god and he really enjoyed it. And he took advantage of it. And then it made him crazy.
He had no intention of coming back to you, just so you know.
Right. You should really get on that Bumble app right away. And whatever version of that is there in 1900. Move along with your life, hon. It's
it's fine.
I get why. I mean, I really enjoyed the audiobook. It was with Kenneth Branagh and I had it on. I had it on while I was cleaning my kitchen. So there's like this dread, you know, boring task on top of a book that wasn't exactly some
drudgery.
You know, drudgery. Like they were both kind of hard. But, you know, he always makes things easier to deal with. I mean, you could get this book easily. You can get the audiobook pretty easily. They're on the Libby app. I think it's worth listening to and paying attention. So many creators in the 20th century refer to this story in different ways. You know, this is, we've had a few literal adaptations, but there were so many other people that kind of touched on the idea. So it's kind of interesting to go to the source.
I mean, it's an exploration of how even a tiny amount of power and lack of supervision can lead to the great calamity, death, and hubris at the best. The writing is good, but it's a real bummer of a story.
Right.
Not the feel-good hit of the summer, of any summer. There have been some good adaptations of it. I do think the Orson Welles one is very good.
It's interesting, and I don't know if you saw this on YouTube. I found a clip, Playhouse 90. and it was Roddy McDowell. And I thought,
oh yeah,
I thought it was pretty good. I was kind of,
it's not bad.
Yeah. I mean, I wish we were around for Playhouse 90. I really love the idea of what they were doing.
Right. Yeah. So innovative.
Yeah.
And then there was the John Malkovich, right?
Right. Yeah. There's been a few. Yeah. But what we're doing today is Apocalypse Now. This is also considered one of the greatest movies of the 20th century. I remember I was young when this came out, but all the grown-ups talking about it. And all the
Everybody was talking about it.
When it was finally on HBO, it was a big deal to see it, you know, at home on your television. These things used to be a great deal. So let's play the trailer right now. It's 4 minutes.
Isn't it like super long?
It's 4 minutes.
Oh,
but
Francis.
Why not be indulgent? Why not?
Oh, come on.
Come on. So here we go.
This is the end, beautiful friend. I've been a soldier since I was 19, and I still haven't learned how to wait for it. I wanted a mission for my sins. They gave me one. Nobody had ever gone on a mission like it before. And when it was over, I'd never want another one.
Your mission is to proceed up the Nung River in a Navy patrol boat. Pick up Colonel Kurtz's path at New Mung Ba. When you find the colonel, infiltrate his team by whatever means available and terminate the colonel's command.
Terminate is extreme prejudice.
My orders say I'm not supposed to know where I'm taking this boat, so I don't. But one look at you and I know it's going to be hot.
Pick your boat up and put it down like a baby right where you want it. This is the first of the night. Air cav, son.
We're coming low out of the rising sun. And about a mile out, we'll put on the music. It scares the hell out of us. My boys love it.
Napalm in the morning. Smelled like victory.
We gotta go up there so you can kill one of our own guys. You mad?
I'm mad.
You think you mad, huh?
No, dead, stupid.
Who's the commanding officer here?
I hear you.
Ain't you?
He was close. He was real close. I couldn't see him, but I could feel him.
These are all his children, man, as far as you can see. They think you've come to take him away, and I hope that isn't true.
Could we talk to Colonel Kurtz?
No, you don't talk to the Colonel. Well, you listen to him.
Are you an assassin? I'm a soldier. You're an errand boy. Sent by grocery clerks. To collect the bill.
Probably seen it 40 times. No
joke. I haven't seen it that many times, but I think like 20 times.
Oh, so many.
Yeah.
Just, In the 90s, in my youth, you know, we had a lot of friends who were theater and film school types. And so there was a great deal of like, oh, let's all get together and watch Apocalypse Now. Oh, let's watch Apocalypse. Oh, I've rented Apocalypse Now. I'm like, oh gosh.
There was really? Different versions.
There was oh, a the longer different versions.
Version. There was
why?
Many versions. Yeah.
Nobody. Anyway, I'm pooping on the movie. It's not a bad movie. It's a very good movie. It's a good movie.
It's a visually.
I'm not going to argue that.
Visually, gorgeous. It's a stunning movie. Okay, let's start wow. with this. Francis Ford Coppola went to film school in the mid-60s at UCLA, and some of his classmates were Jim Morrison and Ray Manzarek of The Doors. If you don't like The Doors, and specifically the song The End, this is
not the movie for you.
No. Did you have a crush on Jim Morrison? When I was young, I had a crush on Jim Morrison.
He was super sexy. I mean, he was sophomoric and a giant pain and also dead. But hot. Jim Morrison in some leather trousers.
I'm telling
and leather
you.
Trousers are gross. But Jim Morrison in some leather trousers, I know.
I'm telling you that. I know. I remember Rolling Stone had an article and it said, Jim Morrison, he's hot. He's sexy. He's dead.
We shouldn't laugh, but that's hilarious.
But yeah.
But yeah, they were, and that's actually how The Doors were formed, is Jim yes. Morrison and Ray Manzarek were in film school together. And then they ended up going into music. Yeah, I mean, that was the time. That's the time that we're talking about here.
Right. And so this movie takes place 1967 to 69, you know, somewhere around that area, where the war is finally starting to catch on at home that it's not that great. And this is from what I understand from my parents. Like the first few years, you didn't want to hear about it. It sounded bad, but you didn't really know. And then more and more newscasters were going over there. More people were filming it and more people were coming back and then telling stories. The American, the world in the 60s changes very much between, like, let's say 64 when the Beatles come here versus like 67, 68 when this is going on.
In such a short amount of time. Okay, but we should go back a little bit. I was just saying before we came on the air that I've been watching this little documentary series about how this was originally a George Lucas project. This was his passion project. Mm-hmm. He wanted to make A Heart of Darkness, let's set it in Vietnam. And it's an apt, I think, impulse. Because
metaphor.
Again, you have this going into a situation you know nothing about, taking charge, killing people right and left, taking command of the natural resources, the hubris, the power, the deadliness, and the debauchery and the death. I mean, yeah, I mean, I think it's a great great idea. He had, you know, he tried for some time to get it made. He got Francis Ford Coppola on board. And it just wasn't getting off the ground And then he had the opportunity. He had made American Graffiti at that point. He has the opportunity to make Star Wars.
I've heard
and
of
so
it.
So his, yeah, have you heard of it? It's this little film. It was originally called The Star Wars, which always cracks me up. Like The Facebook, how it was originally called The Facebook. But the angle that Lucas had was slightly different than the angle that Coppola later takes, in that Lucas's focus was really from the point of view of the indigenous people of the place. So he was thinking, like, what if somebody did The Hearts of Darkness from the point of view of the people of the Congo? And so he's talking about, like, you have this small group of people, the Vietnamese, this huge superpower just swoops in and like mm-hmm. obliterates everything. And how do you survive? Originally, eventually that relationship is what takes down the huge superpower. And so it's really a story of that, which doesn't sound unlike like the rebellion and the empire, right?
Right.
Whereas Coppola is really about, let's talk about what's going on in this war and how everything that's old is new again. I think it's a great idea. I think it's a great idea to take that story and tell it in this way. I applaud that. I think it's a great impulse. And it obviously, you know, made a classic film.
And it's interesting about Vietnam is that, and I didn't know this until high school, even though we were taught very little about Vietnam in high school. I don't know about you.
Wait, were we ever? Can I just say?
Yeah.
You guys need to understand, because Margo and I are older than probably a lot of you. We were probably the first generation to be taught Vietnam, I would imagine, right?
But not much. but not much.
So little.
Yeah.
So little. It was basically like, oh, the Korean War happened and we were fighting communism and, you know, it didn't go the way we wanted, but we still won. Somehow we were taught that we won the Korean War. That's a whole other story for another time. But
in my AP history class, Margo, my teacher, somebody brought up Nixon and they brought up Watergate. And he says, all I want to talk about with Nixon are his foreign policy. Foreign policies.
Yeah. This is the kind of teachers we had.
That's what we had.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly.
If they weren't hippies, it was this the is Reagan.
It was the Reagan era, and it was still like very much a continue. Let's just pick up where Nixon left off, and yeah. So we were taught that it happened.
Right.
We were taught that we were fighting communism, and that's what we should be doing. Definitely what we should be doing. And isn't it a shame that those soldiers took all those drugs? Basically, is the version I got. But also, like, the government kind of hung that entire generation out to dry.
There was nothing done for these men, you know, who came back addicted to drugs and had issues. I mean, that the VA is, it's like the VA was real mess. So we're taught, and then, so this, anyway, so I was telling you, started with this, is I learned this in my French class, and that it was the French that colonized Vietnam.
I learned this in art history class.
Right. I didn't learn this in my history class. I learned this in my French class.
Nope, me either.
Right.
Yep.
So there. If you've met Vietnamese people, I have some friends from there or have stayed there, and you learn French when you're there. I mean, you speak Vietnamese, obviously, but there's a lot of great French cuisine. And there's a
Have you ever had banh mi?
No.
The sandwiches? Oh, they're so good. We have a very large, and that's the other thing. That's the other place I learned about Vietnam was because growing up in Southern California in the 1970s, we had a lot of refugees that came here.
Right.
So I went to school with kids who were from refugee families. And so from them, we learned stuff. But they were very pro-America too, right?
Sure.
And I love me some Vietnamese food.
Yes.
Just saying. They make these sandwiches called banh mi, which it's basically like, you know, all that lovely fresh filling of meat and vegetables, da da da, in a crispy, crispy, crispy baguette that crumbles all over you when you eat. So good.
It's a combination of like Vietnamese and French food, and there's like those, yeah, they're kind of, oh, it's so good.
But no, I didn't know about that. I didn't know that the French were there colonizing and doing exactly what we're reading about in this book. I had no idea.
So it's a good metaphor and it's a good adaptation in that respect. I like everything about that. And I'm interested. I kind of like Vietnam War movies. I find them very interesting. I liked
I did too.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's an interesting, because we weren't taught, we were taught so little and such a skewed vision of what it was. That I do think it's very interesting to get these different perspectives and get more context for these weird messages that you and I got in school.
Right. So this movie is starting to be filmed in 1977. Francis Ford Coppola did very well with the Godfather movies. He won Academy Awards. He was somebody who just was this huge risk taker. He was friends with all of the Spielbergs and George Lucas. He was best friends with these people. Brian De Palma. They all like protected one another.
They're buddies.
They're buds.
They're like all from the same neighborhood.
Exactly. In a metaphor.
Scholastically speaking.
Scholastically speaking, they were padres. They were, you know, amigos. This was going to be George Lucas's project. And then just because of time and what was happening, it went over. George Lucas's favorite screenwriter went over to Francis Ford Coppola. And Coppola is like, becomes obsessed. And Coppola is a really good writer. He rewrites quite a bit for his film. So he's a big reader and he's a good writer. So he's working with this guy and he gets some money from United Artists to do this picture. But and this is the thing you're not supposed to ever do. You're not supposed to put your own money in your projects.
Yeah. Unless you're Francis Ford Coppola, in which case, like, try and stop him doing that.
Well, he'll buy a vineyard. And then he does really well with that. Like, he's good for him, by the way. He's figured this out. But
that's not bad wine, I'm going to say.
No.
I'm just going to put it out there. If you encounter Coppola wine in the supermarket, you'll probably be okay.
It's great.
It's not bad.
Yeah, not bad at all. Who are our people? So we have Marlon Brando is our Kurtz, and he had worked with Marlon Brando when he worked with him on The Godfather, and he had $1 million for Brando. Brando just got $1 million for Superman. So Brando, he's at this time in his life, he's middle-aged. He's no longer like the sex pot he was when he was when we talked about him, what's a streetcar named Desire.
No. But you know, in Godfather, Last Tango in Paris, right. You know, he's still keeping it together here. We also have Mr. Sheen,
who replaced Harvey Keitel.
Yeah.
Harvey Keitel
would have been really good.
I think he would have been too, but they go to the Philippines. And they build all these sets in the Philippines. And then he makes a deal with Imelda Marcos's, you know, the Marcos family, who were fighting like communists you like you want us. And he says to them, they're like, yeah, come here. Film with us. You can use our helicopters. You can use this. But we're fighting communists here. So if we have to go, if they get bored, they're out of here. And
yeah, if we have to call the helicopters from your film set to go fight communists over here, we're going to do that.
Yeah.
Just telling you. And they were looking at they also had really seriously entertained the idea of shooting it in Australia for the same reason. The Australians were like, yeah, come shoot your big Hollywood movie over here. We'll give you helicopters. And hey, our Australians look just like Americans on film.
You know, and we have indigenous like people yours. That we abuse. And it's like, there's all these stories that, so fast forward, he hires Harvey Keitel. They film for a week, and his wife, Eleanor Coppola, filmed him every second filming this movie. They have a very close relationship, and she's a talented director herself.
She's brilliant.
She's very talented. And so she recorded all these conversations, and she said they were watching his performance for the week. It's called The Dailies, in their living room. And then she puts her kids to bed. Sofia Coppola, one of them, like a future star director. She said, I come downstairs 15 minutes later, and he said, we have to fire Harvey. And they just didn't like what he brought. Willard is, I believe, who he plays. And so they had to fire him, and then they bring in Martin Sheen, which is very awkward for everybody.
I'm sure it was.
And Martin Sheen, 36.
Okay. 36, looking like utter caca. not President Jed, what's his name?
Right.
By a long shot. He's the president, like, what was the name of Jimmy Carter's brother? Remember that?
Oh, Billy Carter. Billy Beer.
He's the Billy Carter to his own presidential character. He looks so bad.
He
looks terrible.
In that scene, he looks, well, in the beginning.
Dude.
Yeah. Well, because he's smoking 3 packs of cigarettes a day. He also could be doing other things. It's the 70s. Let's remember that.
Yep.
And he has
not a healthy time.
No, he's a wife and 4 kids. And he does his scene. He filmed on his 36th birthday. He's drunk as a skunk. And he's filming this intense scene. And it's, he busts his hand through a mirror and it breaks his finger. And
okay.
Okay, that's, yeah, go ahead.
So here's my first little beef with this movie. And I was having this conversation with Todd earlier today that, like, I was like, this is what drives me freaking crazy about Francis Ford Coppola. But you know what? You can't argue with success.
Yes.
He's very successful. But they let him, they gave him an entire day of shooting to be drunk and punching things and crying. He's not like, that's not on the script at all. He's just tearing up this hotel room. I said, you know, if I said, what he needs is a Mexican mom on the set. I'd be like, you know what? Get your therapy on your own time. Like we're shooting a movie here. What are you doing? Pull yourself together. You can't act. If you can't act like you're drunk, you have to actually be drunk. Like that's the problem. He's like, you see what is in the movie. He's actually drinking. That is real vodka.
Really drunk.
It's real alcohol. He is really, really drunk. He is seriously crying for real. He is not acting. He was really crying. That footage exists. It is easy to find of him that day shooting he's a mess.
He's a total mess.
He's a mess. And you let him go for a whole day.
Well, okay.
Why?
So, and by the way, let me just say quickly, Hearts of Darkness is a documentary by Eleanor Coppola. And it's fantastic.
I'm never watching it again, but you should watch it if you've never
It was my
seen
dad's
it.
Favorite documentary. I've seen it so many times.
It is one of the best documentaries
really
I've ever
good.
Seen. Yeah, so I've just seen it too many times.
Well, Martin Sheen said, I wasn't spiritually doing well at the time. Like, yeah, no shit, dude. He gets sick. He's been drinking. He smokes, like I said, smokes 3 packs a day. You're not supposed to do that. He gets ill in his hotel room and he feels like he has like a really bad flu. And then he has a pain down his arm. He gets out of the hotel, gets in a bus, goes to the film set. Somebody says, oh, you don't look so good. They take him to a doctor who then takes him to the hospital because it turns out he's having a massive heart attack. It almost killed
36.
Him.
36. 36, right?
Yes.
Ugh.
You don't expect it at that age. You just don't.
Well, maybe if you're smoking three packs a day and downing bottle after bottle of alcohol and doing whatever all else in a single day on the job at your movie set, maybe you do expect it a little bit.
I just so he gets and Francis freaks out. He's like, "Who's?" And he's getting all this bad press because the entertainment press, I don't know if they really do this as much anymore, but they used to love write about movies that are having trouble. This movie we hear on the set is really not doing well.
It was like a cottage industry of like talking crap about the Apocalypse Now set.
Yes, exactly. And there's been certain movies that's been, you know, people do that. You know, it gets all kinds of bad press. They have to do reshoots. They had to fire someone. The weather's not working. Whatever. The director's going crazy. And he was going nuts directing this because he was changing it every single day. So Martin Sheen gets shipped back to Malibu to heal up for 6 weeks. So that he's like, ugh, what do I do? So he's filming all around the jungle. And we should say, thank God he had Robert Duvall, who was 46, but fit as a fiddle. And
right.
He's keeping it tight, y'all.
The picture of health.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. He served in the military.
You can tell.
Yeah.
You can tell. He's great. I mean, I think for the most part, the performances are really good. We have our little baby, Lawrence Fishburne.
Who's like 15 when he made this movie. I mean, he's
great.
He's great. Sam Bottoms, RIP. He's really good. We have Frederick Forrest, who I don't think he's ever been better. I really like him.
I love Frederick Forrest. I love him. Remember when he was the dad on Valley Girl?
That's right.
You see the movie Alley Girl?
That's actually my favorite performance of him. I think he's...
I love him.
And is it Colleen Camp who plays the mother?
Yes.
Because she's in this movie too. Okay, so this is another thing that makes me crazy. There's no women in here. And of course, they're in... Yes. The only ones he gets are Playboy playmates that, you know, are mauled in like 5 minutes by the...
Yeah. But I mean, like the book, then the movie... I think the whole first third of the movie is awesome.
Same.
All the opening stuff, the setup shots, the scene with Harrison Ford and the colonel where like, this is the assignment. This is who this guy is. So all of that setting up, I think, is really well written, really well acted, very well directed. It makes a lot of sense. I love when he first gets on the boat and we're meeting all the guys on the boat. Then there's this whole middle third that I could live without, which is just like, again, encountering, just like in the book, it's the same thing that I don't like about the book, like this whole thing of like, we're going down the river and oh look, there's this thing happening over here, and oh look, there's this uprising that makes no sense over there, and okay, they're attacking the boat. There's one attack on the boat that is directly out of the book, out of the source material. And all like that whole middle third, I think, is just way too long. The whole thing with like the Playboy USO thing,
yes,
way too long.
Bill Graham
playing himself,
yeah,
which is kind of cool. And I do like the shots when they finally get to where Kurtz is.
Yes.
You know, however many men down we are at this point. You see the temple. You see like the spooky people on the boats. And you can see that some of them are Americans. You're like, what's that about? And then just like all of the carnage that's going on there. I think that part is all really good. I like Dennis Hopper. I think he's super good.
Dennis Hopper is so tweaked out of his mind. But it works because that's the character. That's what, you know, they're all on speed. Yeah. They're all on weed. They're all on, you know.
Yeah. At this point in the journey with these guys, you're like, oh man, there's not a sober person in this whole country.
That's how they cope. That's how you're coping with this quagmire, this war that's like not going anywhere. And so we finally find Kurtz, and let's talk about Brando. Bless his heart.
This my favorite scene from Hearts of Darkness, by the way, is when Brando turns up and Coppola gets his first gander at him after he has fought to get Brando for this picture. He really puts his neck out for this guy. And Brando is just like giving the middle finger to Francis Ford Coppola from the first minute. That is the point of the documentary where I just feel so bad for him. I'm just like, oh, dude, this is not going your way at all.
Well, let's say this. So Kurtz in the book we just said, emaciated. Like this guy is a mere sliver of himself. That's the whole thing about Kurtz. He is smaller than the man he was before. He was a giant of a person. He's withered down to nothing because all of this took everything away from him. And then we have Brando, who's 60 pounds overweight and just didn't read the book, didn't read the script. He just wants Francis Coppola to read the book to him to give him ideas. So Francis Coppola has to read to Marlon Brando, who's once again being paid $1 million. A lot of money in 1978, by the way.
That's
pretty good change.
For somebody who's a major risk. Let's just put it mildly.
If you thought someone was going to have the heart attack, it was either going to be Coppola or
seriously.
Brando. Coppola's losing weight, by the way, while he's doing it.
Dramatically.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. So he's the one that lost all the weight. He's the one that's going crazy. And you see him, he does these diatribes with this poor wife. He's just like, I don't know. I don't want to be.
Nothing is so terrible as a pretentious movie. I mean, a movie that aspires for something really terrific and doesn't pull it off. It's scum. And everyone will walk on it as such. And that's why poor filmmakers, in a way, that's their greatest horror, is to be pretentious. So here you are, on one hand, is trying to aspire to really do something. On the other hand, you're not allowed to be pretentious. And finally you say, fuck, I don't care if I'm pretentious or not pretentious, or if I've done it or I haven't done it. All I know is that I am going to see this movie. And that for me, it has to have some answers. And by answers, I don't mean just a punchline. Answers on about 47 different levels. And it's very hard to talk about these things without being very corny. You use a word like self-purgation or epiphany, they think you're either a religious weirdo or an asshole college professor. But those are the words for the process, this transmutation, this renaissance, this rebirth, which is the basis of all life. The one rule that all man, from the time they first were walking around looking up at the sun scratching around for food and an animal to kill, the first concept that I feel got into their head was the idea of life and death. That the sun went down and the sun went up. That the animal, the crop, when they learned how to make a crop, it died. In the winter, everything died. And the first man, he must have thought, oh my God, it's the end of the world. And then all of a sudden, there was spring and everything came alive and it was better. I mean, after all, I mean, look at Vietnam. Look at my movie. You'll see what I'm talking.
Yes.
Did I tell you I met her once?
No.
Zillion years ago when I worked at the Met, my very first job at the Met out of college. And when I was still a cashier, that was my first job at the Met. And she came in and bought a bunch of film books, like you would think she would.
Right.
And I was like, oh my gosh, this is Eleanor Coppola. I was so starstruck. She just had she was really sweet. And she just had this like unflappably chill energy. Yeah. She's just like freaking stoic, steel backbone lady who is not bothered about anybody's drama.
She's 90 now. Nice. And still directs movies. She's been directing.
She's brilliant. Yeah, she's great. I love her.
So he's going crazy. He has to read the book to Marlon to get into the mood of doing this.
Are you kidding me? Yeah. Right. Story time. He has to do story time.
He has to do story time. He'd done all these scenes, like Margot said, the second third of this movie. And it's because Martin Sheen's back in Malibu recovering from a heart attack. And so they have a stand-in. And then Martin Sheen comes back and he looks slim and tan and fit and happy. And he's like, well, this isn't going to work. So he's trying to wear him out again.
CBR Street Gang, this is Almighty. Standing by, over. CBR Street Gang, this is Almighty. Standing by, how do you copy?
They were going to make me a major for this. And I wasn't even in their firm anymore. Everybody wanted me to do it. Him most of all. I felt like he was up there, waiting for me to take the pain away. He just wanted to go out like a soldier, standing up. Not like some poor, wasted, rag-assed renegade. Even the jungle wanted him dead. And that's who he really took his orders from, anyway.
End film with Dennis Hopper and Marlon Brando, both of them known to be a handful to deal with. I mean,
but let's have them both in the same room.
In the same room, both out of their minds for different reasons. Both not sure what to do. He's basically yelling directions at them because they're both being so obstinate. I don't know.
He's screaming at them. And like everything they did, I think had to be dubbed over. There's again, like their footage, their non-used footage, the cutting room floor stuff is very easy to find. Go watch a bit of it and enjoy yourself because it is cuckoo bananas.
Yes.
The stuff that ended up in the movie, as insane as it seems, is the gold that he was able to mine out of that
yes.
giant pile of crap that they gave him.
It was like weeks of that. Weeks of that. And he had weeks. To shoot Brando in the dark and just his head.
Just his nose.
Take a chance with us. Come on, baby, take a chance with us. Come on, baby, take a chance with us and meet me at the back of the blue bus. Do young men to drop fire on people, but their commanders won't allow them to write fuck on their airplane because it's obscene.
And it's like, it's just not that okay. So Martin Sheen's trying to act amongst this. And they
doing his best.
And it's really good.
It's good.
By the way,
it comes out really good. It looks great. But you just feel for, I mean, again, if you watch Hearts of Darkness, absolutely. If you've never seen it, please watch it. But you could easily find some of this footage. It's like, you can understand like why Ford Coppola wanted to punch both of these men.
Oh,
you could just see dollar signs just like flying away into the breeze.
Oh, we forgot to mention
every time they talk,
he put in $13 million of his own money, which
he was really out on a limb.
Yeah. I mean, this is a big freaking deal.
He was really putting all the chips in.
Yeah. So but
it pays off.
It does pay off. He finally gets to Cannes. And it's mixed reviews. Some people get it. Some people don't get it. My parents saw it at the Ziegfeld in New York, which was this huge
fancy.
Yeah. And my dad said like it was like one of his favorite movies. But I think when you first see this movie, you're going to be gobsmacked. I mean, yes,
it is impressive, and I think it does achieve what it sets out to do. I think ultimately it does achieve its aim. My only There's a scene that got cut that's I'm never going to watch this movie again. I'm just going to tell you guys about it. But there's this scene in the like extra long version of this. There's so many cuts of this movie, but there's a scene I actually really like where he's in the river and he finds this like lost little community of French people who are still living like it's the 1950s. I love that scene. I wish that scene had been included in some of this other stuff had been cut out, but I think it does. I think, you know, it's, You sure don't forget it.
Yeah. It's beautiful.
It's beautiful.
And the sound work is incredible.
Gorgeous.
I mean,
yes.
The sound of them landing on the beach, you can hear everything.
And that's really good.
My dad said he remembered. Like it was a war movie like they'd never experienced before.
You really feel like you're in it.
Right.
Yeah, you really do. And yeah, I can't think of another movie before that. Since then we've had lots of
immersive
and kind of that generation. That's kind of what they do, like a Schindler's List. Like you feel like you're running on the streets with those people. It's groundbreaking. What can you say? It deserved all the awards. It deserved them. And you know, it's a lot of drama. I'm glad that Mr. Coppola is still with us and still healthy. Because wow, that's a lot of stress. That's a lot for one guy.
Yeah, he went on to do things like Rumblefish, Cotton Club. I think Cotton Club was another one.
I love Cotton Club.
Yeah, me too.
I do love that movie. Lots of movies. I mean, I think he's great. He's one of these guys, again, that generation, they just churn them out. Some of them are amazing and life-changing, and some are just like, they're fine. But they keep going. He just keeps going.
He's a true artist.
So, book or movie?
I'm going to say movie, but honestly, I really prefer the documentary Hearts of Darkness over this. I mean,
I agree. Me too. But of course, movie. The movie is great. I think the movie, I would even go so far as to say that the movie delivers the message of the book more effectively than the book does.
I absolutely agree with you.
Yeah. So let's talk about what we're going to do next.
I'm super excited about this. We're going to go in a different direction here because we had a sausage fest just now with the book and the movie.
Yeah. So I'm ready for a break from the boys' locker room. Please.
Right. So we're going to the girls this time, and it's called The Lost Daughter, and the book is by Alana Ferrante. She's Italian. It was 2008. It's been translated into English, and if it sounds familiar, Maggie Gyllenhaal has directed the movie. This is her first movie she's ever directed. It's on Netflix. It has Olivia Colman. It has Dakota Johnson. It has a really interesting cast. It's about motherhood and it's kind of a drama thriller sort of thing. It's getting all kinds of great buzz. It's only 125 pages, so it's easy to, it's quick to read or it'll be quick to listen to. So that's what's coming up next, The Lost Daughter, and it's available on Netflix.
I'm very excited about that.
Me too.
I think that's going to be super, super fun. Now, where on the internet can people find you, Marco?
You could find me at Brooklyn Fit Chick for Twitter and Instagram. I am on the TikTok now at Margo Donahue. My site is brooklynfitchick.com. And where can people find you, Margo?
Well, not on the TikTok.
Yes.
Yeah, I've not ventured there yet. I have an account, but I've not gone into that realm just yet. Otherwise, you can find me online at coloniabook.com and all of my others, actually including TikTok. My TikTok call out is also at She's Nacho Mama. So anywhere on social media, I'm at She's Nacho Mama. And we cannot wait to talk to you again next week. Thank you for joining us. Hope your 2022 is going well. I think I might have said 2021 before. So I want to solidly say happy 2022, everybody.
Happy New Year, everyone. Be safe. We will be back soon with a new episode. Thank you so much for listening to the Book vs. Movie podcast. We are a part of the Frolic Podcast Network. You can find more podcasts you will love at frolic.media/podcasts. We follow the hashtags Lady Pod Squad and Podern Family. If you want to support the show, you can go to our Patreon page, go to PATREON, and look for Book vs. Movie podcast. We have a basic Facebook page, but we also have a private Facebook group. Go to Facebook and type in Book vs. Movie Podcast Group if you want to join that. You can follow us on Twitter and Instagram at Book vs. Movies. Fill all those words out. If you
you'd like to send us an email, it's bookversusmoviepodcast, spelled it all out, at gmail.com. You can follow Margo D at Brooklyn Fit Chick on social media, and Margo P at She's Nacho Mama. Thanks so much again for checking out our show, and we'll be back soon with a new episode.